Hey everybody, in this episode of AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On, we're getting up close and personal with one of the stars of Bravo TV's Real Estate Wars, Drew D'Angelo. Let's do it.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Yes, some Kygo bringing us into this AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On. Welcome everybody. This is the show, of course, where we get up close and personal with the people both in front of and behind the camera that bring you all that great entertainment that you get to watch at home on your TV set or maybe on your mobile streaming device. I'm one of your hosts, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Now, my guest today has been described as the respectful spitfire in Bravo TV's new series, Real Estate Wars, where he deals with the brutal real estate battles down in the OC. Two teams vying for everybody's listings, what they can get down there. We've got the Relegants group. But who cares about those? We're talking about the McGonagall team right here. And Drew D'Angelo is one of those members. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Drew D'Angelo.
What's up?
Not much. Oh, all right. So we came in with a little Kaiko.
Yeah.
Yes. What is it about Kaiko that you really enjoy?
Just the beat. It's mellow and it's not too trappy. It's not too, you know, hard house. It's just right in the middle. So it's good, like uplifting music, you know?
Very. Now, are you going out to the club?
No. No, those days are long past. I've got three kids. I got a five-month-old today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you. At home, so, you know, I met the woman of my dreams, not at a club, so clubs are out.
Yeah. Was there a point when you realized, like, you know, I think I'm done with this club scene?
Yes. Several times there were points where I was like, you know, I'm probably done with this, and then I go back.
Yeah.
And then, I think I'm done with this, and then I go back. But, you know, when I met my wife at a party, it was just all over.
Well, let's dive in a little bit about your past here.
Sure.
So, where did you grow up?
I grew up part-time in Buena Park with my dad and stepmom, and part-time in Laguna Beach, Newport Beach, with my mom and stepdad. So I got to see both sides of the track, if you will. I mean, both hardworking families, never wanted for anything, but just good family. You know, I was lucky to instead of have two parents, which some people have, some people don't, I had four. And they all loved me, and you know, my stepdad is my kind of idol and mentor who taught me everything I needed to know about real estate.
That's the nice thing about Winnie. It's kind of like having parents that are divorced where you're never sure if they can still get along very well together. Because I know certainly as my parents were divorced, kind of frosty between them. And even though both remarried, still kind of very frosty between them. So it seems like it's great for you to be able to have two sets that still got along very well and still wanted to make sure that they got along well and they took care of you.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say their relationship is, you know, warm and fuzzy. It's definitely frosty, but for me, they did the best that they could for me as individuals and as two separate parental units with one common goal. So I was fortunate enough to be a part of that.
So, I mean, I guess the one thing is, like, growing up, I guess – if you ask like a kid, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I feel like this, like, fireman, policeman, movie star, or scientist, or an astronaut. I feel like real estate mogul is not one of the things that comes into the head.
So, no.
Yeah. It's like,
no. Yeah.
So when does that start kind of coming into your head? Like, oh, this might be something I'd like to pursue on a professional level.
You know, on a professional level, well, first of all, I wanted to be a professional tennis player when I grew up, right?
Oh, nice.
So, you know, I played tennis all throughout my childhood, my teenage years, played tennis in college, ultimately ended up becoming a pro. And then that's when, you know, I kind of got into real estate. But before that, at about like 5-6 years old, I figured like I wanted to do something real estate related because my stepdad drove me out on his Bronco to a development site in Laguna Niguel that he was developing. And that's in Southern California, right by Dana Point. And right by Laguna Beach. And so he pulls up on his Bronco, like, over the hill, and it's just this beautiful ocean view and nothing but dirt. And as a kid, I mean, you love the smell of dirt. You love Tonka toys, right? Mm-hmm. So there was these huge, like, you know, diesel tractors on the site. And so he took me out of the Bronco, which we 4x4'd up to the site, right, which was killer. Took me out, put me on the tractor, and said, if this is what you want to do someday, go to school, do well, be honest, be a good person. And that kind of resonated with me, like, all throughout my childhood. Like, I always wanted to do what my dad did, my stepdad. And he was always dressed in tuxedos, always dressed in suits, always had It seemed like really important people at the house because they were always very serious. You know, while I was like playing G.I. Joes or like Batman, Superman right outside his office, trying to interrupt and see what was going on. You know, and he would always show me like architectural plans and kind of try to teach me what all of these terms were and what those lines meant and why there's a dash in between a line and what that really means. And again, it didn't really hit me until I was older that was really, really what I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to be like my dad.
Now, you mentioned before, you talk a little bit more about that. You mentioned a pro in tennis. Mm-hmm. What was it about like tennis that kind of said like, hey, yeah, I this is something I enjoy. I'd like to pursue this professionally.
It was something I got really good at. It wasn't a team sport. You know, football I was a little too small for. I had gotten a concussion in PE diving for a basketball while I was in high school.
Wow.
And that kind of ruined my football career because the doctor said, look, if you get hit in the head hard enough again, you could potentially die. So my mom was like, that's not happening. And both my dads were football players. So for me not to be able to do that, it was like, okay, well, what other thing can I do? I'm not tall enough really to be that fast at swimming, even though I love swimming, avid surfer. Professional surfing was kind of out because I never wanted to surf, you know, a wave bigger than 10 feet. It just scared me, right? So tennis was one of those things where it was like it taught you principles, rules, and it, at the end of the day, it was you, God, and your opponent. You know what I mean? And you had to kind of – it's metaphoric, but – you had to stay within the lines, you know. You couldn't go outside of them.
Is it different than golf in the sense of like, I mean, they're both kind of individual sports, although you're playing against an opponent. Well, I guess the opponent is kind of the field, mm-hmm. the course. Is it very different in that sense?
Well, first of all, they're both very hard sports. Golf is like the hardest game known to man, in my opinion. And I'm pretty decent at it, but it's – the focus and kind of stamina that you have to continue to believe in yourself, like if you hit a bad shot, you know, you're going to make another good one, right? There's some similarities there, but tennis is far more cardiovascular than golf is, like far more. So
now what do you think of like the current state of American men's tennis?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah?
I love it. I think it's great to see what the Americans have done. I mean, you know, most of all, Davis Cup. You know, mm-hmm. coming back into the limelight, if you will, with like players like Jack Sock, you know, and some of the other guys that are on the team. It's amazing to see these guys play. It's just such a different level. You know, I mean, my serve was pretty decent at, you know, 5'8". And, you know, these guys are serving like 140. I mean, as soon as they started serving that big, I was done with tennis. Like there's no way to hit something like that back. You know, I mean, I'm genetically not blessed to be 6'2" playing on the court with these like behemoth of men. So I do think that it's they're just made differently today. You know,
what was your surface of choice? Were you a clay man, a grass man?
I loved grass. I'm more of a traditional player, serving volleyer. I love my one-handed backhand, but grass is not abundant in California. You know, unless you go to the desert, unless you travel elsewhere. So hard court was my, you know, surface of choice.
What, because I've talked to a few golf pros, but I've never really talked to a tennis pro.
Mm-hmm.
What is that like when you want to pursue that professionally, just in terms of playing? Are you constantly on the road? Or are you constantly going to different tournaments? What is it like?
Well, you're constantly playing different tournaments, you know, trying to qualify for the ATP, which I never got to. So you're playing qualifying matches. And you're playing a lot of good guys, you know, Division I players in college. Those guys are just a cut under, you know, being ATP professionals. So when you play against guys like that, it's tough. And it's just tournament after tournament after tournament. It becomes your life. You know, but for me, it was more of a segue into teaching tennis, you know, because I fell in love with the passion for teaching people, and particular kids, and building relationships through that. And so it was a great segue into it, you know, chasing that and saying, okay, I need to do something a little bit more mellow, I think. And so I taught and, you know, created a business, ran a couple different clubs with some partners, and was given the opportunity to, you know, be involved in the community and kind of help kids learn the game that they fell in love with. And I to this day, I mean, I've sent a couple kids to college on rides as a coach, so that's rewarding. Let me just put it this way. I've created a lot of relationships with friends in the community because their kids would come to the court and play, you know, and they're 20 years later, here we are, and they're, you know, 28, 29 years old, still playing tennis. So it's a very rewarding experience.
That's going to be cool to see somebody that you taught so young still loving the game.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. They still can't beat me, but it's great.
How often do you play now?
I'm good for about maybe once a month now. If I really get into it and I get the bug, you know, it's one of those things where I'll play 3-4 times a week. But I got to get the bug. Yeah. You know, it's you fall in and out of love with it when you've played it so much. It's like, okay, if the U.S. Open is on TV and it's constantly kind of in my face, then I want to play it more. But if it's not, I just forget about it, and real estate keeps me more than busy.
Would you consider like the U.S. Open or any of the Opens kind of like a Super Bowl where it's like shut everything down? I'm just camped out here in front of the TV watching this.
For sure, U.S. Open, Wimbledon, by far the two biggest tournaments I think in the world. So,
do you feel like, because I know in terms of teaching kids and getting them to love that sport, people that want to pursue it professionally, just I guess amongst the sports, if you're thinking basketball, football, soccer, tennis, golf, in terms of pursuing something and maybe having being able to achieve something on a professional level, where do you think tennis kind of ranks in the ability to maybe possibly succeed in that?
It's very difficult. You know, just like golf, that's where there's some crossover as far as similarities too, because there's so much talent out there and the level is so high that to get to where you need to be, it's fitness. There's so much that goes into it. And I think it's just really hard. I think it's one of the hardest sports to become a professional at, which is why there's so few tennis players that are ATP ranked.
Is that tough when you're – because I guess you want them to enjoy the game.
Yep.
But then also kind of temper their expectations. Like, you can do this, but you might not make it professionally.
That's a great question. You know, every time – I never ran into a child who said or a child's parent, should I say, that said, hey, I want my kid to be a pro. You kind of have to organically build that. You know, if you fall in love with something, then you're going to pursue it. And then through that pursuit, you'll find that, I guess, flow of, you know, do you want to take this to the next level? And then there's levels. You know, you go from junior tennis, you play your local club tournaments, and then you play, you know, normal tournaments around, and you play national tournaments. And then once you're there, it's all about dedicated parents. You know, the parents have to continue to pour in, and it's a full-time job for them. I mean, I have a business partner of mine who travels the country and the world with her 16-year-old son who plays golf. He will ultimately be a pro, but he's playing 18s. He's like the number third ranked in the world for his age. But that's her life, you know, and she's dedicated that. She's retired to that, and not a lot of parents have that time. So, you know, the cream rises to the top in this game, and, you know, I so many times her parents say, just get them through college, right?
Yeah.
And that's okay. But even getting to that point, because, you know, high school talent now is so great, particularly in Orange County. I mean, it's like the tennis mecca. You know, you've got kids that just, that's all they do night and day. And their parents are constantly pouring into them, you know, wanting them to get a scholarship. So it's difficult.
Do you feel like at that point, is it more that the parents want them to do this more so than the kids in some cases?
Some cases, yes. The ideal case is that the parent says, look, you can do whatever you want, which is like I am with my kids. Whatever you fall in love with, we'll pursue that. And if you end up not liking that, that's fine. At least you gave it a shot. The worst is when a parent says, you have to do this because I want you to do that, I think, because then the kid gets burnout, you know, and they go from being a tennis phenom to, you know, dropping out of college and not completing college. And I mean, that's the extreme case, but it happens more often than not.
Are you kids interested in tennis?
My kids are interested in tennis, and they're, let's see, my son Max is 9. He's going to be 10 in March. My daughter turns 8 next month, or actually the end of this month. And I purposely kept tennis away from him. As much as I want to teach him because I know I can, it's like, hey, what do you guys want to do? You know, my son's kind of into surfing right now, which is great, a little bit of skateboarding, a little bit of biking, loves his Legos. My daughter will just do whatever daddy says. So she's my princess. That's my baby. And, you know, obviously my 5-month-old, he just likes to laugh. So once they say, hey, dad, let's go out to the court and do it, I'm all for it.
Will you take it easy on them? Or are you like, no, if you're playing me, I'm bringing everything.
I can't confirm or deny that I would be easy. I mean, I'm pretty tough on them. So, yeah. Like, especially about a game that I know most everything about, mm-hmm. And have lived it, it's very difficult to teach your own child. So, but then again, you know, their grandma's always like, well, I'll take him to get tennis lessons. I'm like, no, you won't take him. I'll teach him. No problem. So it's just a matter of getting them on the court, but they're very good. They've got natural talent for sure.
When you're watching a tennis game, mm-hmm. Can you just enjoy it for what it is? Or are you constantly looking at the players and kind of just picking apart different things about how they're playing?
It's both. It's honestly both. It's so tough to watch a tennis match and not, psychologically kind of put myself in their position, watch their footwork, you know, how many times are they jumping in between the striking the ball? Are they getting underneath the ball enough? I mean, there's so many technical aspects of it that I get into. And then sometimes if it's like players I don't really care about, I'll just watch it, you know?
Yeah.
But my favorite player is Roger Federer by far.
Yeah.
Huge fan of him and the way that he conducts himself in the public eye and what he does, as a philanthropist. So, everybody else I pretty much don't care about, you know?
When you decided you want to kind of like, you know, I'm not going to pursue tennis professionally anymore. Was it just as simple like, I'm going to now start pursuing something in real estate? Or were you kind of doing some stuff in real estate at the same time and it was easy to kind of jump over? Or was there things in between?
It was part and parcel, one of necessity, right? I mean, my skin was almost like black, right? Literally. Because I was on the court like 15 hours a day. And I was tired. And I had always tried to tell my dad, like, Dad, let me in. You know, let me do something in your business. And he'd always say no. He always kept me out. Like, nope, you're not ready. You're not ready. And that's his classic line. Dad, I want to work for you. Nope, you're not ready. And so out of necessity, it was like, I got to get out of the sun. I'm getting burnt out. I mean, I'm 21 years old and I'm tired. And, you know, I'm working 6 days a week. And I've got this, you know, tan that won't go away, right? And you know, you there's only so much money you can make in teaching tennis, right? And at the time, I had said, look, I've run my own business. I did, you know, teaching for the city of Fountain Valley, city of Newport Beach. I ran the Newport Beach Tennis Club Junior Program and the Futures Program at the Balboa Bay Club Racquet Club. So I went to my dad and I said, Dad, look, I've run my own business. I'm ready to learn. And that's all he was waiting for, was me to say, I'm ready to learn. And he said, okay, you're going to come in, you're going to deliver my mail, you're going to get my coffee, you're not going to talk, you're going to do everything I tell you, and at the end of the day, we'll go over the notes that you've taken from all the meetings that we have. And that's what I did. For literally about a year and a half, 2 years of my career in land development, that's what I did.
During those meetings, what were things that you were kind of learning that you did not understand? Like, I did not realize that my dad was... This is part of what he did.
So being a land developer is you have to be – you're not an attorney, but you have to have a pretty good legal mind. So in one minute you're being you know, you're looking at legal documents, so you have to have a legal mind to look at those. On the other hand, you're being a politician because you're talking with city mayors, city supervisors about trade-offs, you know, and about legislation that could affect your development downturn. You're dealing with public agencies like, you know, U.S. Department of Fish and Game, U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, you know, Army Corps of Engineers. I never knew my dad dealt with people like that, you know. And you have to be a biologist because you have to know what flora and fauna is on your property. You have to know what an EIR is. You have to know what a mitigated negative declaration is. You have to know how to write a specific plan. You have to know the different elements within that. You know, why are streetlights put up in a circulation element? Why are there roundabouts in a street? All of these things that you have to learn in urban planning to become a pretty decent developer. And you have to understand the market. You have to understand finance. So you're a banker, you're an attorney, you're, you know, a politician, all in one meeting. And I never knew that. I never knew how difficult it was to create something from land. You know, raw land is beautiful, sure. But creating a building on it, that's a whole nother ballgame.
How far are they looking into the future for that? Are they just looking, well, we figure like in 1 year, we just look at your head, or like 10 years environmentally, something like this could be happening, or land-wise or city-wise, things that could be coming into play?
So typically a city has a general plan, and then within that general plan, there's specific planning areas. So it's typically about it depends on, you know, how old the city is, when it was established, when the general plan was adopted or specific plan was adopted, and how many amendments have gone through it. And is it a sustainable document, you know, looking forward to the future? It kind of runs in perpetuity, you know, looking out, and is amended as the needs of the community are needed. You know, if there's a community need, then you go in and you first amend the general plan and then amend the specific plan. So it's all dependent upon what the needs of the community are at that time. If there's a huge population growth, then obviously you got to change things. If there's an economic demand for commercial properties, you got to change things. If there's not so much of a commercial demand, but there's a housing shortage, then you've got to go in and you've got to change these things. And that's what people don't understand about city legislation and city governance, is that these guys do know what they're doing.
I can't imagine there's a lot of moving parts that a lot of people do not realize. Just trying, like you're saying, just to get one simple thing built, there's so many other pieces that are part of that.
Yep. There's so many different moving parts that you have to be knowledgeable about, and you have to have a good team behind you, and you have to hire good consultants, and you have to hire good technical consultants like biologists and civil engineers that understand these things and have gone through that before. And you know, the cool thing about my dad was I never realized that he had kind of started with the County of Orange and worked his way up. So he had done all of these things. And at the time, you know, I thought I knew everything. I didn't realize how much of that information he was pouring into me. And until I, you know, the economy kind of busted when it was a little bit too late. You know, and coming back, that's what helped sustain my career, is that knowledge that he poured into me. I mean, he made me do spreadsheets by hand, man.
Oh, man.
Like, to get the math right. Like, it was no joke. He made me go out with the biologists for the surveys, right? I mean, I electrocuted myself on a horse fence. I'm like a surfer kid, yeah. Right? Like, from Newport Beach, who had never been on a horse farm ever. Didn't know that. Why would you electrocute a horse, right? So I guess they had turned up the amperage. And I had just gone, and I went out for a survey. This is how young I was and naive, in a suit. Right? thinking, okay, I'm the developer's son. Like, I got to look good. I had no clue what the hell I was doing. So I ended up getting tired, and I reached my hand onto a gate, and it was the amped up gate. And I had it sparked, and I had electrocuted myself. So I called my mom, and she's like, "Baby, are you okay?" And I'm like, "Mom, what the hell? You didn't tell me this was the deal." And then I remember a biologist saying, you know, "Look, you got to kind of be careful because you're being tracked by a mountain lion right now." Because I cut my teeth on a 444-acre ranch out in Tribeca Canyon. So to anybody that knows, that abuts the Cleveland National Forest. There's a lot of wildlife there. That's a huge wildlife corridor right now. So I've got plenty of stories for that. But there's a lot you need to know.
Man, it's... Certainly, you loved and respected your dad growing up.
Always.
But once you kind of got more insight about what he's doing and everything that he's kind of learning and doing, how much does your admiration of him kind of increase as you're learning about everything that he does?
It's, you know, my mom worked alongside him. So she made it look so easy. She, you know, she was the kind of power behind the punch. And so she always lifted him up and always supported him. And whatever he did venture-wise and business-wise. So it just – when I kind of came into my own in the business and understood it from a 30,000-foot level, looking back and saying this is the total picture of development, it brought us closer, because they had finally, as parents, been rewarded with the fact that what they had poured into me had paid off, right? And then for me, it was rewarding to give back to my parents. And it was this kind of maturation process that happened in my mid-20s. And then, you know, I got married and had kids, and the economy fell apart. And then I kind of reinvented myself and went out and ran a private equity fund. And that really, learning the banking side of things and how money is deployed and the time value of money, particularly other people's money, it was very important to add on to what I had already learned. And then, you know, coming back out of it about 5 years ago, my dad had gotten, unfortunately, into a car accident. And we underwrote our first deal back from the economy together on his hospital bed on the back of a napkin, and we successfully completed it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So ever since then, we've never looked back. I mean, that's my dude. That's my partner. And my mom is the silent partner who has an opinion about everything. God bless her. But she's a professor at Boston University and smarter than I could ever hope to be. So sometimes I have to put my ego in check and listen to mom, you know?
When, as you mentioned a couple times, you mentioned like the real estate market kind of crashed down. What's that like to be in the midst of that and seeing things kind of tumble down around you?
It was very, very scary. It happened, it seemed like overnight. You know, partners stopped funding, offices started closing, and you'd kind of heard rumblings about it, but when you're in the development game, you're kind of hoping for the best, right? Like to be a developer, you've got to have a pair, you know, a big pair, and you got to be able to take mitigated risks, you know, not gambles. Those are developers that fail and go broke. You've got to be able to take mitigated risks. And so what we thought, and I think a majority of us thought, is that the market would correct itself, but not fall out from underneath us. And when it happened, I mean, you know, we lost everything, you know. And I had seen that happen a couple of times in my childhood with my parents where they took big risks and we rebuilt. And we took big risks and we rebuilt. And that's just market cycles as a developer. I mean, you've got to be able to sustain those types of things. And that kind of helps me in the real estate transactional world because nothing really fazes me.
Is just the idea that you want to at least set up like a reserve so that when everything kind of goes in a cycle and it does go down, that you like, all right, I can weather this out because I've already got something in reserve to tide me over.
Yeah.
And once it gets back up, I can start going.
Well, it's create the relationships. And having gone, I had never gone through it as an adult, right? When 96 hit, I had just turned 18, which was kind of a downturn in the economy. And then it started booming again. And I never really was affected by anything because I wasn't in the business. I didn't pay attention to economics, so to speak. I was just kind of living the dream. I was 18 years old, doing whatever I wanted, surfing every day, partaking in things I shouldn't have partaken in, and you know, just living the dream. And then when I got into a professional career, you learn what's important, you know. And yes, the answer to your question is yes, you have a reserve account, but relationships matter. You know, always make sure that you pay your investors back. Always make sure that you do right by them before yourself. And if you do that and you sacrifice a little bit, you know, you'll be able to sustain yourself and find capital in down markets. And that's what's important.
Because when you said you had to reinvent yourself, as you go about that process, what are things that you kind of feel like, I got to get rid of this or this or change something in the way that I approach something moving forward?
That's a great question. So for me, it was, again, it's out of necessity, right? I don't think people change because they want to change. I think they change because they have to change. And I had to change. I had to, you know, provide for my family. I had a newborn at that time, which was my son, Max. I had to create a steady stream of income. And so I went out and I wrote a business plan on how to invest and divest in foreclosure real estate, had it blessed by, you know, numerous guys that knew more than me. And I'd always, my philosophy is always hang around people that are smarter than you and have more than you do. And you're going to learn something. And so that's kind of been my MO. And so I went to guys that were smarter than me, that had been to places that I had never been. And I said, how does this business plan look? And they said, it looks terrible, but here's what you need to do to change it. And so finally I was able to change it to a point where I was able to present it. And a very good friend of mine, Matt Bailey, shout out to Mr. Bailey, introduced me to a friend that he was in a master's program with at UCI. And this guy happened to be married to an heiress of a very large fortune. And so I presented my business plan. I had taken a look at their portfolio of properties and said, look, let me sort out kind of how you can start to really gain money, show you where the holes are. And so I did that for like 4 months for free. And then finally they said, okay, well, here's an amount of money. And it was more money than I had ever seen in my life. Go out and spend it and do what you did for our portfolio and build upon it. And so I did. I took $40 million. I invested it into the foreclosure market. Did well.
You make that seem so easy, Drew. Just $40 million. I invested that.
It was overtime. Oh, it was still, overtime.
Man, yeah. That's just huge. I mean, huge numbers. I mean, I guess, you know, growing up and being around those environments, those kind of numbers doesn't seem as daunting.
No, I was never around that much money.
Okay.
Ever. That was more money than I had ever been around. I mean, I was carrying cashier's checks of $10 million or more in my backpack at any given time. You know, just to go to foreclosure sales and buy properties. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my life. And it taught me a lot about accountability because, you know, and security. You know, you have to be secure. You have to be accountable. And, you know, I was able to reconcile every dollar and cent. And to this day, these people are my partners. So extremely blessed for the opportunity that was given to me.
Well, I guess just one kind of side note, kind of dealing with all this, in terms of buying something, like, right. Say me as a potential homeowner.
Sure.
Certainly, you know, the types of houses that I could afford. I mean, I know I look pretty stylish, Drew, but, you know.
It's the guys that dress like me that work for the guys that dress like you. So let's get that straight.
Oh, I only wish that were the case. I wish that were the case right now, Drew. Sadly, it's not. But yeah. Like, so certainly the houses that I could be in the market for, sure. Compared to a lot of the people that you work with down, say, in the OC or mm-hmm. elsewhere, are the challenges that we're facing are pretty much the same. They're just kind of scaled up. Or when you're dealing with that much amount of money, there's also a whole big other bag of issues that come into it as well.
Depends on the circumstance. More money, more problems, you know, more complications. But again, if it's a, you know, apples for apples real estate transaction, it's going to be pretty much apples to apples. It's the same thing. If it's a divorce, it gets a little tricky. If it's a trust, it gets even trickier. It just depends on the vesting entity. And it depends on the client and kind of the baggage that client comes with.
Man. All right. So at what point then does Bravo start reaching out and saying, hey, we're thinking about doing this series, Real Estate Wars. Are you interested in being part of this?
I was so funny story. So I got a call one day as I'm driving home from one of our developments in San Diego. And I was on the phone with our partner, Greg LaMarca of Alliance Development. And I said, hang on. And this phone call, I wasn't able to pick it up. And this lady says, so-and-so from World of Wonder Productions. And I'm like, this has to be one of my bros playing a trick on me. And Greg's one of those guys that will play a trick on me just to, like, you know, do it. Because my nickname to my developer buddies is Hollywood, right? And I don't know why. It just is.
You look very stylish.
Oh, I appreciate that. But again, I'm it's all looks. And so I called this lady back, and I kind of ignored it, like hands, you know, arm length transaction, if you will. And I said, okay, who are you? She goes, I'm so-and-so from World of Wonder Productions. I said, what is World of Wonder Productions? I didn't know. I had no clue, let alone it's a huge production company that does a lot of the Bravo shows. I was such an idiot not even to do, like, hit Google or say, Siri, what's World of Wonder? I thought it was like a porn audition that somebody was calling me about, and I was going to be like, hate to break it to you, I'm married. Right. I'm off the market.
Well, we got recommended by Greg. He said that you really want
to. Right? Yeah, exactly. And so I immediately changed my tone when I found out exactly who had referred me. And she said, no, John McMonagle had referred you. And we want to do a Skype interview and talk to you about the dynamics of the show and what the show is. And I said, okay, fine. I hung up the phone and I screamed because I was so psyched. I mean, you know, there had been points in my career and my time in my life where I'm like, God, I'd love to be on TV because it looks glorious, mm-hmm. right? It looks cool, you know, but you don't know what goes behind it. And so I ended up doing a Skype interview, and I was told, you know, sit up straighter, you know, talk more into the thing, be a little bit more peppy and all this. And at the end of the day, I was those things that they wanted me to be. And I guess that was good enough for them. And they said, look, you're cast. And I said, that's great. What's the show about? And so they went into what the show is about. At the time, it didn't have a name. And they said, look, there's four other cast members that are going to be with you. And they named who the cast members were. And I was just psyched. And it was light speed ahead. They said, we're not going into, I guess it's a pilot series. Mm-hmm. This is green-lighted for production. So you're literally going from Skype interview to production. And it was like, what does this even mean? And so I sat down and I talked to wifey about it because we make decisions together. Husbands out there, always make a decision with your wife, never without. And we talked, and I was the last one to sign the contract because I wasn't sure that I wanted to expose my family, not knowing what it was, to that. Mm-hmm. And so finally I sat down with John and Hannah McMonagle. And they had said, This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm telling you, take this. And I did.
So you, because the way the show is kind of structured, we got the Relegance and we got the McGonagall.
Irrelegance, yes.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. right. Had you already been working with John as kind of the team, or was it kind of more a team established for the sake of the show?
No, the McGonagall group is a group that has always been established. John has always had a team, and it's always been a top-producing team. And I've been a part of John's team for 5 years. I've known John for 20. He was my parents' realtor.
Wow.
Yeah. But he'd hate that I said realtor. He's my parents' agent. Sorry, John. and he just did a bang-up job. He always was well-dressed, smelled good, spoke well, and handled business for my parents. And my parents always made money. And there was another guy, Ron Felsott, that worked for him. And Ron's just like the coolest guy ever. And so when I had gotten my license, which was kind of a right term from being a fund manager, if you will, I called John and I said, you know, when I get my license, I'm going to work for you. And at the time, he didn't believe me. And I ended up getting my license and I sat down in front of him and said, here I am. The rest is history. So.
But you had no idea that he was even thinking of you. Like, I'd like to add Drew into this. I think he'd be a great addition.
I had no idea. No clue. I mean, John and I are friends. And we've become brothers over the past, you know, several years, but I had no idea that he even thought of me that way. You know, I mean, this was a guy that's like, in my opinion, up there in mm-hmm. the real estate world. And for him to say, look, Drew, you're a rock star. I'm going to recommend you. That was a big deal. And all of the cast members, Leo, you know, Hoda, who's my partner in real estate, Hunter, we're all eternally grateful for that belief. I mean, we had no idea that he even thought of us that way.
That's got to be a very cool feeling to kind of get that sort of like, yeah, I'm giving you the nod, kid. Let's go.
It was very humbling because it's a lot to live up to. You know, I'm so used to in managing money and being a developer, being behind the scenes and not being so out there in the public. And so when you're thrust into that capacity, and it's important what your social media looks like, and it's important, you know, the things that you say, it's a whole different world. So it's an adjustment period, but it is humbling beyond anything.
So as you mentioned, it's like, hey, being on TV would be kind of cool. It seems like it'd be fun to film this.
Right.
Now going through the whole process, was it what you thought it was going to be? Was it more challenging? Was it easier? What was the experience like compared to what you thought it was going to be?
Deep thought. It was, it depends on the day, mm-hmm. right? It's a lot more fun than I thought it would have been, put it that way. I thought it was going to be a lot more work than it actually was. And it was just like us doing what we did. You know, we came together as a team, and I think it was an organic thing. Whereas the Irrelegance team was put together for that purpose, and they've done a great job, and they're a bunch of great people. They're still irrelegant, but we ultimately ended up, we thought we were going to be nervous on camera in our first like test thing, and we just ended up crushing it. And that synergy that we had as a team just carried forward. So every time we were together, it was always fun and games and jokes and just being ourselves like we are normally, right? But we chose to conduct business, not try to be TV stars. Mm-hmm. And that's what the difference between, when you see the stark differences between the two teams is, I think. And both teams do a great job. I mean, both teams have some really capable agents on them, particularly me.
So, I mean, certainly there's a bit where it's like you get to just do like a scene where you're talking about the business of the day.
Yeah.
As you said, kind of easy to crush, fun. Mm-hmm. We have that chemistry.
Sure.
But then there are those moments, too, where you've got to do, hey, we need you like to, for the McGonagall group team. We need a shot of you all walking down the street together as a team. Wait, stop, head back up. Let's do it one more time. Moments like that, you'd be like, how many times do I need to walk down the street? Did you have those moments too?
Well, they did that, but we're so, I'm going to say this, and this is humility, but confidence. It's confident humility. We were so good at that we just wanted to get through it. So it was only like two or three times. But there were times like that, you know? Yeah. And when you have a guy like John by your side, who's kind of groomed for this, right? I mean, the guy was on Oprah, right? And absolutely killed it. I mean, to this day, if you watch it, it's like, that's how a agent, I almost said realtor again, John, sorry. that's how an agent, a luxury agent, is portrayed. You know, he's the kind of that quintessential guy, and he changed the game for everybody. So for us to be a part of that, it raises your level, right? And we were constantly elevating our game.
So now, of course, the concept of the show is it's the McGonagall Group against the Relegants.
Yes, I got you to
say it. We'll do it, Relegants.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'll admit, as I watch it, I was siding more with you guys than with them. Because, I mean, JoJo, she's an interesting character. Like, watching the show, like people you may have worked with or interacted with in business situations, or even in some aspects, maybe a little bit socially.
Sure.
But this has given you a chance to see maybe a lot more of just their personal life than you've ever known before. For people that, like, oh, I've always kind of saw them as just competitors.
Right.
What's it like when you're watching the series kind of back and you're getting to see the little slices of JoJo's life or other team members or of Team Irrelegance, and you're like, whoa, I did not realize that this is what they were about.
Well, I like to think of myself, again, a great question. I like to think of myself as a very understanding person. I never judge, right? It's against my principles. So there's a lot of pressure that's put on you to perform business-wise, you know, socioeconomic-wise, and she's got a family. And, you know, she's also going against her nemesis, right? And she's thrust into the public spotlight for that. So there's a lot of pressure there. And she handled it, I think, the best that she could with what she was given. But it's an interesting thing to see kind of everybody else's life, because I've known them all as either friends or competitors. Mm-hmm. So to see inside them as on a personal level, it kind of brings down the defenses a little bit. And you start to relate more with them rather than in a competitive aspect, as a human being aspect. I mean, Sparrow and I are very close. He's like a brother to me. So, and he's a guy that's taken me under his wing, and he's kind of navigated this Hollywood-esque type deal. He hosts, I think, the Miss Globe. So he's been in the spotlight for a long time, and he's got good advice. He was the president of the Newport Beach Realtors Association. So it's a good guy to know. And, you know, I know Casey and Kylie and JoJo, and I respect them all.
You know, I mean, as somebody that doesn't have to say as many nice things because I don't interact with them on a regular basis.
Right.
I did find, like, JoJo's, I did like to say she had a spiritual advisor on call at any moment. It was always interesting to me.
Yeah, my spiritual advisor's up above.
There you go.
All I got to do is put my hands together and say help.
Let me ask you about one scene. There's a scene where you and John, and you're meeting Kylie out on a piece of land.
Sure.
And there's Lisa's there with her. And, there's the way the scenes cut together, it feels like you kind of throw her under the bus because you know she's leaving and she's moving back east.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just like, we're just going to throw a dig in because we can? Or it's just like, you know, was it an accidental slip up?
There's nothing, you know, we're very methodical at what we do. So there's no, with the exception of a couple of things, there's really no, when it comes to competition, accidents. You know, it was, we knew and that she was leaving. There was an opportunity to perhaps make us seem like we were in a better light, so we chose to do that. And look, Kylie in no way, shape, or form is an angel. I mean, at any given point, I mean, we're called the McMonobots, the McMinions. I mean, that's Kylie, mm-hmm. right? And she's just got, like, the sharpest tongue. I mean, she's pretty special and uniquely gifted when it comes to kind of like burns, if you will.
Yeah.
And you kind of sit there sometimes and you're like, damn it, that was a really good one, Kylie. And so that was an opportunity to kind of like give it back a little bit. And just so happened that we did.
It's just a nice awkward moment where she feels like she's got to like, all right, I was not expecting to get thrown under the bus at this moment. Now you got to try to recover it, but gracefully.
Yeah, she recovered gracefully. And at the end of the day, the bottom line is that she should have told Lisa. For those of you that haven't watched, she should have told Lisa prior to her departure and created a plan for exit. And she didn't.
So now the idea is that she's moving back east. As they say in the show, like, oh, I can still come back and do stuff. Has she come back or is she still back east?
She's still back east.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, she's right when she talks in her interview about, you know, there are things you can do. I mean, you can be an agent from your cell phone, but there's nothing like a person-to-person relationship,
especially at the kind of numbers that you're kind of running.
She's a closer for sure. So I mean, she walked away from business here that was pretty substantial.
Oh man.
Yeah.
One other one I want to ask you about too is his portfolio. So the big old thing is that you go in, Johnny goes and meets him. It's like, and this guy, I will not accept an offer that's less than 30. And then he backs down an offer that's less than 28.
Yeah.
This, wow. Was he, because we see, Irrelegance coming at the end of the season and say like, "Oi, hey, this is wrong. There's no way this is going to sell at 28. You're ridiculous to be asking this much. You should be asking less." Who was right in that respect? Was John like, "Hey, yeah, if this is what you want, we'll do it," or did he need a little tough love talk and say, "You got to come down. This is unrealistic."
There's two sides to that story. The first side is first of all, Amir's portfolio is completely legit, and you know, it's when you're in his position, you're constantly testing the waters to see what your agents are going to say, right? Having been on the opposite side and managing money and having agents work for our business, I can sit back and say that I've been in that position before. And, you know, John handled it correctly when later on in the episodes, he sat down with Leo and said, here's the comps, here's what we need to do. We need to do a price reduction. And you need to kind of update the home. To come in, and it's very convenient, of course, after the listing had expired or after, you know, Amir had taken it off the market, to come back and say, oh, we would never have told you that. So, I mean, that's not exactly the smartest move. I mean, you weren't the agent in the room to begin with to say this is the case. Now, do I believe that Spiro would have said or JoJo would have said, hey, we're not going to list it at this? 100% sure they probably would have said that. But again, not one of them has done a deal over, I would say, $18 million. So John has done, you know, a majority of Southern California's $20+ million sales. And there's a reason why he has confidence when he says, okay, it's 25, great. And they don't. There's a reason why he's first in the room and they're not.
I do like, just, I will not accept an offer less
under 30 million then under 25.
Yeah, I was like, just kept talking, I was like, all right. As we're getting ready to wrap up, I imagine like part of the job too is just not knowing everything that you've already got to know, but also just you got to be part psychologist too. You got to be able to, every client is going to have their own particular quirks, needs, wants, desires, and you got to be able to kind of know how to navigate that stream as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I imagine it never gets boring.
It's never boring. I love what I do. To call it a job is kind of a sin. You know, it's I get up every day, I get to sell the dream. I get to create lifestyles for people. And I get to be in beautiful elements, you know, beautiful homes that most people imagine what they look like from the inside. And I get to represent the interest of very good people. You know, I mean, we're picky about who we choose as our clients. You know, if it's a really tough client who's going to be a pain in the ass, we're probably not going to go with them, because we know that we're going to butt heads sooner or later. But if it's a client that's, you know, willing to do business and believes in kind of the vision that we're setting out marketing-wise, look, the McMonagle team is the team to go with.
I would imagine, though, is it hard to carve out off time for you? Because the people with these kind of deals that they want to set up, I can imagine it's like, no, there's no day off because I might need something just like this and you need to be able to help me.
It's Sunday, bro. I'm here. I mean, you know, it's hard to do that, but if you compartmentalize it and you have a good support system behind you and you have an understanding family, and most importantly, you communicate with them about kind of what your goals are as the head of the family, then it becomes easier. But there's only so much time, you know, and that's why tennis is once a month, not 3 to 4 times a week. That's why surfing's like twice a month, maybe not every day like it used to be. There's sacrifices that you have to make, you know, and a day off, like vacation, freaks me out. My wife's like, oh, we need to go here. And I get like heart palpitations. I'm like, we need to what? Huh? What'd you say? Like, baby, I love you, but maybe next year,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
So it's just making time, you know?
But I have to imagine, much like with your mom, your dad, when it kind of have somebody in your corner to be able to kind of pick you up, dust you off,
sure,
send you back out in the fight.
Sure.
That's got to be able to have a great thing to be able to do what you do on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, they're the people that taught me to never quit. You know, when the universe and circumstances knock you down, gain wisdom through the lesson learned, pick yourself back up, walk with confidence because you got through it.
Drew, it has been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, man, this has been an honor. Thank you so kindly.
Please tell that to my friends.
Yeah, it's an honor, friends, whoever you are. This guy's awesome.
Drew, if they want to continue to follow all your adventures that you're going on, whether it be in real estate, maybe the occasional tennis game,
yeah,
or whatever that you're going to be doing now that your nickname is Hollywood, who knows? Where's the best place to follow you on social media?
So the best place to follow me on social media is Drew D'Angelo on Instagram, Drew D'Angelo on LinkedIn, Drew D'Angelo on Facebook, and www.themcmonagleteam.com. Look for me on that website. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been the very entertaining Drew D'Angelo.
Yes.
Now, of course, Real Estate Wars, the season wrapped up, but everything is available on demand for Bravo, or you can go to bravotv.com as
well.
Vote
for season two.
That's right. Get a season two. We got to figure out, we got to see another season of these two teams battling against each other.
Yeah, Kylie, come back.
That's right. Well, she come back from back east. Let's see. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Please join us again for another fantastic episode of AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On, right here on AfterBuzz TV.
Right on.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.